This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we have a Postcards from the Prairie essay about springtime chores on a ranch. But speaking of springtime chores, it is our spring member drive, and it's a great time to invest in quality programming. That laugh you heard is Director of Radio Bill Thomas. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Sure, and I don't think of it as that much of a chore.
No, it's
really nice to hear from the people who support Prairie Public, and you can be one of them. You can call us at 800-359-4145. Or you can go online at prairiepublic.org, and programming like that you hear on Main Street today is supported by your contribution at whatever level.
And what we really like about Main Street is that we have time. We don't just have to hear the who, what, where, why, when, how, blah, blah, blah. We have time for context. We have time for thinking about things. We have time to learn about what inspired someone to do something and the process, because, you know, usually you have an idea and then things change because that's just how life works. So we really love that we have the gift of time on a show like this. That's the kind of programming that you are supporting when you call or text the word donate to 1-800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org.
And I want to tell you, if you haven't done it before, maybe think about coming in at the $5 a month level, $60 a year, but you can set it up monthly on a credit card or coming out of your bank account so you always see it there. You can change it, cancel it, raise it, lower it, whenever you want. And we do have this fun gift. I know a lot of people like the NPR programming that we do, of course. We have NPR playing cards because it's the 50-year anniversary
that's
of NPR.
Adorable.
So that's fun. We'll send you a deck of playing cards and you can play little games while you listen to Prairie Public. And again, to make that contribution, call 800-359-4145, or you can text the word donate to that same number, 800-359-4145, or go to prairiepublic.org.
And those playing cards, that public radio keeps people engaged on those long drives, of course, across North Dakota, listening to public radio. We have those big, expansive views. Some people might get a little bored at the non-changing geography, but others find it to be a very expansive place to live, and they meet that expansiveness with imagination. The Pfeiffer sisters, Jackie Pfeiffer McGregor and Janine Pfeiffer Knopp, grew up outside of Monokin, which is near Bismarck, in the 1950s. They write about farm chores, the first time they got electricity, and learning how to make clothes from feed sacks in their memoir, While the Windmill Watched, A Slice of Rural America in the 1950s. Jackie, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Janine, thank you for joining us today.
It is exciting to be talking with you.
Where did this idea to include the windmill's perspective come from? Usually memoirs are told from the point of view of the authors.
When we considered writing the book, actually Jackie had begun with her memoirs years prior to my idea of recording my memoirs. And it was to the point that finally when we merged our thoughts together, my husband and I were talking and I said, Jackie and I have different ways of presenting the topic or the information that, that we want to include in the book. And so we need some way, some intermediary who can bring these concepts together, the concepts of writing, different writing styles together. And so my husband, Fred, said, well, why don't you consider the windmill? Because that was a very important part of our barnyard at the time. You know, the windmill is tall, its structure is strong, it's a solid part of North Dakota, and it saw everything that happened in our family and within our community. And actually, when Jackie would climb to the top of the windmill, she could see the Capitol building, which was just 10 miles from us. And so we knew that the windmill would be a wonderful observer of all the activity that we wanted to record in our book that happened in the 1950s.
And before your husband voiced this third character, did you realize you had strong nostalgic feelings for the windmill?
I personally had a lot of experience with the windmill, just in the fact that the water that was drawn from the ground by the windmill was used to water our livestock, and I was very much associated with our livestock. I'm quite an animal lover, and so I was with my dad quite a bit when it came to being around the livestock. The windmill, and one thing that I can remember too about the windmill is that with all the North Dakota winds, that whirligig on top was going all the time, as long as it was put in gear. And I had kind of forgotten about the fact that there was a lever that you could use to start and stop the whirligig. And so that made a difference too. And right, when the stock tank was full, then usually someone had to run out and flip that lever so that the windmill would stop drawing water from the ground.
Well, Jackie, I'm thinking Janine here mentioned you climbing up to the top of the windmill. My family was not farmers, but we grew up on a farm when we moved to Wahala, North Dakota. And I remember doing some really dangerous things that we should not have survived in childhood, like sliding down Quonset huts on cardboard sleds. What were you doing climbing up a windmill?
Well, that's a good answer. The windmill is sort of a metaphor for our lives in that, as Janine mentioned, I would climb to the top and look around and see the Capitol building and just see the 360-degree vision. And I always wondered, what was beyond that? What was beyond that horizon? Whereas, as is mentioned in the book, Janine took about three steps and said, that's enough for me. So anyway, as it happens, I mentioned a metaphor. I love to travel, and I love to see different places and explore, and I'm kind of a detective person. I want to know, well, what about that, or why? And so that is the metaphor that we used. My story started in 2004 as a family history for our daughters and for their children. Both of us have daughters, and both of our daughters have children. But Janine has a talent for looking beyond the box, and so she suggested that we write a book. And I emitted a, what, you must be kidding, Sal, not me, I'm not an author. Are you kidding? Well, anyway, one thing led to another, and we discussed the potential topics, and we spent many hours on the phone recrafting and crafting sentences. Mm-hmm. And so windmill is truly a product of collaboration. And our story, While the Windmill Watched, has become a history of the era and the community, not only of these two little girls who grew up on the prairie of North Dakota, but beyond, and how many things that happened in the United States affected those rural people in North Dakota.
Well, Janine and Jackie just said there that you have this wonderful skill of forward thinking, and I would even call it a kind of intelligence. Why do you think it is so important that people tell their stories? I mean, usually memoirs, autobiographies, you know, in North Dakota, you'd think of, you know, Mr. Bubble, for example.
Right.
Yes. As Jackie stated, we wanted to do this for the benefit of our children so that they would get a taste of what our childhoods were like, what our community was like in which we grew. And because now there's so many distractions in life that rural communities, the whole landscape of a rural community has changed. All these small towns that surrounded and Monocan, which is our hometown, it's 10 miles east of Bismarck, have somewhat shut down, you might say. Even now, Monocan no longer has a post office. And at the time that we grew up, the post office, the grain elevator, the school, which is still going, the two churches that are there, it was a cohesive unit. The folks living in Monocan and the surrounding farming community were all supportive of each other. And as one neighbor former neighbor who, when we interviewed her about her thoughts on life in the community, said, no one thought that one was better than the other. We all work together for the best of the community. And that's, I think, what comes out in our book is the community love and camaraderie that we had for each other. There was a local homemakers club, which was like the welcome wagon of the community. Mm-hmm. If you were new to the community, they reached out. And at that time, too, the homemakers club was a way of making and allowing the women of farm families feel more connected to the community. They mm-hmm. weren't just there serving as homemakers and as wives and as mothers, because at that time most women did not work outside the home. And yet the connection that they had, if they weren't listening to a radio homemaker perhaps on KFYR or as what we had done, what my mom had done, it would have been a lonely existence. But because of the need for each other in the small communities, that's what allowed the farms and the communities to survive in that time. We wanted to be able to share that experience with people of our younger generations who don't have any idea what life was like at that time, because it is so different now.
Yeah.
And plus, also, if we can stir up memories in readers who did live at that time, or whose parents lived at that time, or who can make some kind of connection with what we say and with what we share in that book, that makes it even more rewarding for us as the authors and for them as the readers.
Yeah, it really struck me in the book how much it is a story of, female agency and strength and friendship and, yes, that building of community and connection. And we mm-hmm. have a woman on our show once a week, Sue Balcom, who runs a small farm outside of Mandan. And she also did this program called Women Behind the Plow. And I remember talking to her about telling these stories of women's roles on the farm and why, to her it was so important to include this perspective that is usually left out of the settlers, the pioneers, the farmers, like those perspective stories. And she said that some of the women said, well, they weren't always talking about what they were doing because they were too busy just doing it.
And I think it also had to do with the fact that in that time, of course, money was not flush. One of Mom's favorite sayings to we girls was, money doesn't grow on trees, girls. And that in itself made us very aware that we had to be thrifty in what we did. And it was a time when you worked very, very hard in order to earn an honest dollar. Still, I think in some cases it's very much like that, but it was certainly prevalent back in that era.
Well, you learned a lot of hands-on skills doing that efficiencies. Mm-hmm. You ladies were actually making clothes from food sacks. So what were they actually like? Because to me, a sack that food would come in would maybe be burlap.
No, it was 100% cotton.
Okay.
And they were very pretty, quite colorful. The fabric did not fade. You know, it was pretty good quality.
Of course, I was quite young at the time that Mom was still using laying hen mash or chick mash feed sacks in order for her sewing projects. But what I specifically remember as I became a seamstress when I started 4-H at age 10 was the fact that chicken feed sacks, and they were beautiful. We'd go to the PV elevator in Bismarck and we'd select the whatever fabric we thought was the prettiest for us. And so those feed sacks, from what I recall, were 36 inches wide. And on a pattern that, on the back of a pattern, the amount of yardage that you would purchase for a garment would be determined by the size of the person and the width of the fabric. Well, at that particular time, pattern companies did have on the back yardages required for 36-inch wide fabric or 45-inch wide fabric. And it finally came to the point, I can remember during my years of sewing, that pattern companies removed the 36-inch width fabric requirement because there were no more feed sacks being used, oh. and 36-inch wide fabric just wasn't found anymore.
Wow.
But we never really thought that it was such a bad deal to have clothing made out of feed sacks, or at least I didn't. I thought it was kind of fun. But then it really became fun when we did get to go to an actual fabric store and see the amazing selection of bolts of fabric from which we could choose.
Yeah. And are you still sewing today?
I sew very little because my business is in food production.
Right.
I'm a dessert baker, and so that is what my life is consumed with anymore. And so, no, I don't do a lot of sewing, not even buttons or patching. I focus on food, creation of food.
On the other hand, I don't really have an interest in food and baking. But I love to sew, and we have a small community theater here, and I can hardly wait till the next production, because then I get to create something or other for the stage. That's my thing. My biggest project and my one with the most rewarding was to make 11 hats for the Ascot scene of My Fair Lady. Oh, I just love doing that.
Yes.
As well
and
as
millinery is such an art.
I learned a lot, and I love doing it, and I think in 100 years before that, that's why I would have been found, in one of those millinery shops.
Yeah. You've learned these skills, you know, taking anything that comes your way and turning it into something else. And that happens so often in rural life, especially in this time period. And I'm really curious, Jackie, what are some of the things that really come to the top of your mind when you think about how having a very outdoorsy and hands-on childhood impacted just the way that you go through life?
Living on a farm taught me self-reliance and creativity, and it's been beneficial wherever I have lived. One of the things that I still hear in my mind is my mom would say, "Think, Jackie, think." And so that would help me, even now today, well, how can you look at this another way? What you don't have what you need, what can you use as a substitute? So living her words, as well as all the farm experiences with Dad, because we were Dad's boys, there were no brothers, and we just really enjoyed working with Dad. He was one in a million.
Yeah.
But anyway, the North Dakota prairie instilled in me just an appreciation for also for uninterrupted views and vistas and solitude. And so we appreciate sparsely populated areas. And my husband and I have kind of leaned toward living in those areas.
The background that you have very much informed the lives that you took. Also, just this role of 4-H. And I'm thinking specifically in helping young people have the skills for public speaking.
I was always in the speech contest, started out in demonstrations, and Janine kind of took that, and then I would go into the speech, and that really helped. First of all, one needed to do some research for the speech, and then one needed to get up in front of your local group and your county group, and then sometimes state group, depending upon how far you took it.
And Janine, running a business, I imagine it helped in that.
Oh, yes. But it all starts really ahead of that. On the inside, probably the second page of the book, there are two pictures. One is of Jackie at age 5, and one is of me at age 2. And those were the first professional pictures that Mom and Dad ever had taken of us. Hmm. And I'm standing there and holding up my skirt because I am so shy. Mom said that was the only shot they could get. That photographer got where I had a smile on my face because I was so shy and fearful. And that's how it was with me. I would much rather have hidden behind Mom's skirts. She wore the most beautiful circle skirts, and they were perfect as a camouflage for me, so I didn't have to talk to people when I was little. But then getting into 4-H as a 10-year-old when I did my first educational presentation, or at that time it was called a demonstration. It was on making muffins. And that was the impetus of giving
developing my self-confidence, to speak in front of people, to have courage, to go beyond the person I was inside. And that shy person started metamorphosing. And I give so much credit to the 4-H program for all the wonderful opportunities that were given to me to become a leader and to become have a better developed personality and to not be fearful of being in the public eye.
Yeah. So did you ever go up 3 steps higher up that windmill then?
No. No, I didn't do that. Thank you for asking.
That was Jackie Pfeiffer-McGregor and Janine Pfeiffer-Knopp talking about their memoir, While the Windmill Watched, A Slice of Rural America in the 1950s. We are going to hear more of that conversation still to come on Main Street, but we are going to remind you now of how you can support programming like this. 1-800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. I just love a conversation like this where you hear how, yes, they very much recognize that life on a farm, especially in the 1950s, was very difficult. They were up early, they were doing chores, but then they used that, all of the knowledge and skills that you can really only get with a hands-on childhood like that, and the work ethic that comes from working the land and living in tune with the land, and then make careers out of it.
Yeah, one of the things that I've talked to sometimes people who are hiring managers in different places, art museums, big aerospace corporations, and different things. And one of the things they say is that people who are raised on farms know how to do stuff. They know how to
right?
do a lot of different stuff, and they know how to make it work. They may not have that real deep, technical, logical focus knowledge, or they may, in some area that they've gotten interested in.
But it's far more practical knowledge.
Yeah. And they just handle a lot of different things. And they do like to be self-sufficient, and we like to be self-sufficient here at Prairie Public, and we do that by being listener supported. That's the public radio approach, is asking the people who listen to us to chip in. So, we're happy to get contributions from businesses and get grants from different agencies and governments and so on, and that helps us out a lot. But being supported primarily by listeners like you who are listening right now. You're listening right now.
You're the ones who make it work.
Yeah. That gives us an independence and self-sufficiency that's really important in being able to do this kind of programming here on Prairie Public, like talking to these sisters with their fascinating memoir that bring out so many details of farm life. Now, you can join in and support Prairie Public by calling 800-359-4145, or you can text the word donate to 800-359-4145, or you can go to prairiepublic.org.
It really is that simple, but it makes all of the difference. Everything that you hear on public radio on Prairie Public is made possible through member support. Call or text the word donate to 1-800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. We are going to continue our conversation with the Pfeiffer sisters, but now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota school districts are receiving federal money directly from COVID relief bills. As Prairie Public's Dave Thompson reports, the districts will have to follow federal guidelines, but the state has little say in how the money is spent.
North Dakota schools have been receiving money from the COVID-19 relief packages under what is known as ESSER.
Elementary Secondary School Emergency Relief.
State School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says the money can be used mainly for one-time spending, from personal protective equipment to dealing with learning loss because of a lack of in-person instruction. And she says the first ESSER money is allocated according to each school's Title I funding formula.
And Title I is based on the number of students in their school districts that are living below the poverty threat threshold. So those students receiving free and reduced lunch, and those that are below the poverty line, according to the census.
Baszler says that means the amounts each school district receives varies widely.
For instance, Kindred School District will be receiving $386,423. Warwick, smaller student size, but Warwick will be receiving $5,633,567. So there is certainly no one-size-fits-all.
Baszler says the state has little to no say in how the money is being spent. But she says the federal government has tasked DPI to monitor what the districts are doing and if the money is being spent according to federal guidelines. And she says, in addition, the North Dakota legislature is requiring a report on learning loss.
Not just how well are your students doing overall in School District A, but how well are your students with disabilities in that district doing? How well are your students who are living in poverty doing? How well are your students of Native American ethnicity doing? How well are students of English language doing?
Baszler says they will also have to report on how the districts spent the money.
Not only is our federal government very keen on knowing how they're spending the money with it and allowable uses, our state legislature is very interested in knowing how our schools are using those funds to help our students be academically successful.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And North Dakota's First Home program continues to be popular. The program helps low to moderate income people who have not owned a home in the past 3 years to receive assistance to purchase housing. State Housing Finance Agency Director Dave Floor.
Yeah, I think if you talk to, you know, the realtors, and I think this is across the state, you know, demand is high. Homes are not staying on the market very long. And, you know, the home builders, from what I understand, are busy also.
To qualify for the First Home program, the maximum income limit is $117,530. And the acquisition cost limit is $331,979 for a single-family home. Floor says interest rates remain favorable.
For the First Home program, it's below 3% at 2.65%, and that's below what the market rates are.
Floor says in 2020, more than 1,200 households used the First Home program, and he says the numbers remain strong for 2021. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck, naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to continue our conversation today with Jackie Pfeiffer McGregor and Janine Pfeiffer Knopp. The sisters grew up outside of Monocan, North Dakota in the 1950s and use that as the backdrop for their memoir, While the Windmill Watched, A Slice of Rural America in the 1950s. In this next part of the conversation, we talk about how even though they wrote the book together, and of course, as sisters, they are somewhat alike, they said they also enjoyed exploring the many ways they're not so similar.
We are similar in many ways, and yet we are very different as well, and we point that out in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the windmill particularly points it out as it speaks, too, about what happens in our lives.
Well, let's have you each describe how you see each other and then, or how you see yourselves and then how you see each other. Jackie, describe your personality. You know, you've put it out there. You're the one climbing to the top of the windmill.
Well, as I said earlier, I'm a detective. I like to know why, or I look into things deeply. I really like history, and I think that has that goes back to my searching for why. I like specific facts, something I guess I can grab onto. Even though I climb to the windmill, I think as I've gotten older, I'm probably a little bit more reserved than that. However, my husband and I still love to travel.
And how do you describe Janine?
How do I describe
Janine?
Yeah. Oh, wouldn't you like to have her describe
herself? I want to hear both of you describe both.
I'd like to hear this. Well, Janine digs a little deeper than I do in that. She likes to go beyond this, the facts and delve into the emotions. And she's a very good business person. Very good. We laugh a lot, you know, so we entertain each other.
Yeah. Janine, how do you see yourself?
Well, it is very interesting. I've thought about this as we've gone through and written the book, in that I like to keep my feet planted on the ground. I like the mm-hmm. solidness and security. And yet I'm the one who is the entrepreneur and the risk taker. My husband and I have farmed for since our married life, which is over 40 years. Mm-hmm. And when you farm, there are never any resolute that there will be an income, that there will be a source of income.
Right.
There may not. You might get rain. You might get drought. You might get hail. It's just the luck. It's just how God wants to handle it at that particular year. And so because of my farming life, our farming life, and my background coming from a farm family, I'm used to that. I love living on the farm and having raised our family on the farm. And because of the entrepreneurship that we have as farmers, I guess I don't think twice about being a business person because I have an idea and I want to see it come to fruition. Mm. But yet I think my, at the age that my husband and I are now, and I drive by these empty buildings and I think, oh, Fred, I can just see this certain business being put in here. And he said, I think the best thing to think of is to just drive past that building and not even think that, because he's kind of, I think he's to the point that, well, we've taken enough risks in our lives. Maybe we can slow down on that.
Yeah.
So I am the risk taker, even though I wasn't the windmill climber.
And how do you see Jackie?
She loves adventure. She loves to learn, and she loves, as she mentioned, the specifics. Sometimes I say to her, well, there's curiosity, and then there's curiosity on steroids. And so you have to learn when you can express your interest and how far you can go when visiting with other people. So we are different in that respect. And we both have high morals and integrity. We respect honesty very much so. And that was taught to us by our parents and really their parents before them. It's a legacy that we give to our children. We always knew that our parents, Jack and Eudora Pfeiffer, were great parents. But at this point, when we are in our 70s, and can reflect on our childhood, and of course our parents have been gone for a number of years now, but it makes us so respectful of them as our parents and how they raised us and how they were active members in the community and how they reached out to others. They had warm and loving hearts for other people. And other people in the community respected them for that as well. So we hope that when people read the book and from what the windmill says too about our parents, that Jack and Eudora Pfeiffer will be highly thought of.
And how do you think Jack and Eudora Pfeiffer would react to this book?
We think that they would almost find it unbelievable, because they never wanted to necessarily take credit for the things that they had done. They weren't braggarts by any means, but I think they would be thrilled by seeing this collection of memories from the 1950s, and to know that we honor them with this book, and we honor our Monocan community with this book, because the neighbors in the community were just wonderful neighbors, and we do have them quoted in the book. We have them pictured in the book. You know, the book is more than just Jackie's and my story of the 1950s. It's the story of our community, and it's the story of the fabric of rural America. And just so happens that we lived on the Great Plains, which was a wonderful place to live.
They would have been delighted, and their buttons would have been bursting, but in a quiet way. You know, modesty was keyword.
Well, that's an essential quality of farm life, don't you think?
Farmers are salt of the earth. And in my parents' situation, they were a team. They were partners. And we reiterate this time and time again in While the Windmill Watched. Especially what comes to mind is the part when a mom and dad decided to participate in the Shelter Belt Project to help with soil erosion. And that, I wasn't born yet, but Jackie was, were you one or two when this happened? And mom and dad planted by hand approximately 4 miles of trees as windbreaks on the farm. And they not only planted them, but they would load up 50-gallon barrels of water and haul those out to the field and water these little stick trees by hand every night, when in the summertime when they could go out and do that. And this was after a full day's work, and yet here they were. They worked for what they believed in, and they were rewarded for it, both financially and in the fact that with the ideas that they were good people, and they came away from life with, I don't think, with any regrets of what they had done, because I believe they felt they had lived a great life, and they had raised 2 daughters that they were satisfied and they loved and they were very proud of.
Yeah. Janine and Jackie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. We thank you for taking time
for
this little question and answer session.
That was sisters Jackie Pfeiffer-McGregor and Janine Pfeiffer-Knopp, and the memoir is While the Windmill Watched, A Slice of Rural America in the 1950s. You can check out their website for how to get a copy of the book or attend a reading at www.whilethewindmillwatched.com. They will be speaking, COVID permitting, June 6th. In Monokin. And again, you can get the book at that website or at the NDSU bookstore. I really love, Bill, how they talked about through it all how much a book like this would have meant to their parents, because the parents very much that put the nose down and just keep working, do a good job, take pride in the work itself, but you don't always have to talk about, how good you are at something like that. Just a very, classic North Dakota stoicism, nose to the grindstone, and do good and let the work speak for itself.
Yeah, well, I hope that our work speaks for itself, but we have to talk about it a little bit when it's our membership drive.
Yeah, sure.
And but obviously nobody is constrained to respond. It's a free will response. So if we're not telling the truth when we say that this work is valuable and that it means something to people, well, nobody's going to respond, but people do. And we've heard from a lot of people so far in our spring membership drive, which is going on now through Friday. And we are hoping to hear from you as well with your support of Prairie Public that can cover things like this memoir and other memoirs and other important things that help give us insight into our life in this region, as well as, of course, bringing you NPR and the national and international news. And you can do that by calling 800-359-4145 or text the word donate there, or go to prairiepublic.org.
And, of course, when you're doing it during a show like Main Street, it's kind of like voting for Main Street. You can call during Morning Edition and say that you like Main Street, of course. But when we hear from you during a program like this, what you're saying is we appreciate long-form, interesting conversations, especially when you're talking to sisters, they talk over each other. They have all this insider information that I don't have. And I never had to worry in the course of that conversation about trying to cut them off. I have the luxury of letting people talk. You're supporting programming like that when you call 800-359-4145. Eliza Blue is a South Dakota writer and musician. In addition to a weekly column that appears in several print publications, she also produces a radio feature called Postcards from the Prairie. And today, she shares an essay about springtime farm chores.
I met Mason in college. He was athletic, charming, and played bass in the coolest band on campus. I didn't know him well, but I liked him. Everyone did. One night, at a loud, crowded house party, we ended up in a small group talking about music. The Stones were really on to something with that lyric, "You don't always get what you want, but you get what you need," our mutual friend Tracy shouted, trying to keep her drink from sloshing out of her cup as someone squeezed past her. "It's really true." "Totally," I shouted back, partially because I agreed, but mostly because Tracy was from Brooklyn and was much, much cooler than me. Said Mason. "I don't know, because I feel like I've gotten pretty much everything I've really wanted and almost nothing that I really need." He didn't sound sad or angry, just matter of fact, his gaze calm as he took a long sip from his drink. "Whoa," I said, into the long pause that followed his words. And in that moment, felt a seismic shift in my understanding of my own life. Was it possible that I also was mostly only getting what I wanted and rarely what I needed? It would explain a lot. This time of year is by far the most intense on a ranch. Lambs and calves are born at all hours and in all kinds of weather, and we need to be close by in case the cows and ewes need help. That means checking on the herd and flock regularly throughout the day and the night. Life narrows down to the confines of our barn and pastures, the hours filled past brimming with chores and obligations. Meanwhile, here on the northern plains, winter and spring can never seem to decide who is actually in charge of April, and sometimes May too. One day, I'll be sweating in short sleeves, trying to turn a lamb that's in a breech presentation, and the next day, my husband will appear on the porch, his coat soaked through from sleet and snow, carrying a chilled down newborn calf in his arms. On a ranch, loss and worry is bundled into the joys of seasonal rebirth. For all the many successful births, there are also inevitably deaths. Lambs and calves born during foul weather in particular have a lower chance of survival. On the other hand, when the weather is warm and dry, as it has been this year, we fret over the lack of moisture and the threat of prairie fires. But this time of year, more than any other, I can easily see the distance between what I want and what I need, something that was much harder to observe during my suburban upbringing, and that has been a gift beyond measure. And what do I really need? I need to believe my labor has purpose. I need to see that the animals under my care are thriving and that our stewardship allows the other members of this ecosystem to thrive too. I need to be out in the hard wind and rain, my frozen fingers fumbling to milk a cow or bottle feed a baby lamb, so that when I return to the shelter of my house, I am flooded with gratitude for the warmth. I need to know there's a good neighbor a phone call away who will offer a piece of hardware to fix a broken water tank or a tube of ointment to treat an infected udder. In the summer, the new babies won't be so fragile anymore. The herd and flock will graze in the pastures, the chickens chase bugs across the yard. We will ride horses under the colored flag of evening just for pleasure. There will still be plenty of work to do, but we will have time to limb the expanse between what we want and what we need with the laughter of our children playing nearby, the animals healthy and thriving, and the stars that rise over our heads as the sun sets on another day.
After years on the road as a traveling musician, Eliza Blue now practices regenerative agriculture, raising fiber sheep and grass-fed cattle with her husband and two children. You can learn more at ElizaBlueMusic.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public,
Know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You know the sound that sounds so NPR? Let's say well-spoken, easy to imitate.
You're listening to The Delicious Dish on National Public Radio.
Well, we wondered, where did that even come from?
There was a sound that I and other young reporters would go for because it was just the sound of the network.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join us to sort it all out on 50 and Forward, an anniversary celebration of NPR.
50 and Forward, an anniversary celebration of NPR, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
NPR is powered by local stations across the country, and this station is powered by you. Public radio would not exist without your support. Thank you for 50 years of NPR and counting.
Call 1-800-359-4145 or join us online at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 4th. May is National Historic Preservation Month. Today, we highlight a North Dakota property on the National Register of Historic Places. Construction of the George and Beth Anderson House in Fargo was completed in 1959. The structure is a bi-level brick house done in the Wrightian style, inspired by the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright during his Usonian period. The house was nominated for the National Register of Historic Places because it embodied the Wrightian style. Largely unaltered, it maintains original masonry walls and woodwork throughout. Yet, there is a little more to this story. The house was actually built by the granddaughter of Frank Lloyd Wright, Elizabeth Wright Ingram, and her husband Gordon, a former Taliesin apprentice under Wright. The couple was based in Colorado. Three homes they created for residents in the Fargo-Moorhead area are still standing. Architecture was in the blood of the Wright family. Elizabeth Wright Ingram had decided by the age of 14 that she wanted to be an architect, joining her grandfather, as well as her father, John Lloyd Wright, who also invented the Lincoln Logs children's toy. One of her daughters, Catherine Ingram, became a professor of architecture at the Pratt Institute in New York. Elizabeth found her own place and style amidst her family's work, and she founded the Wright Ingram Institute. She was passionate about architecture and community and became an environmental activist educator, promoting responsible designs. She was a fellow of the American Institute of Architects and wrote numerous works. The George and Beth Anderson House in Fargo was, in Elizabeth Wright's words, derivative of Wright's style. Beth was interested in architecture and landscape design and was involved with the planning of their house. And most of the remodeling projects were done in keeping with the original design. In 2003, the kitchen was remodeled by later owners, with Elizabeth Wright Ingram giving her approval, noting, "Houses are breathing things. You have to keep maintaining them, or they grow stale." Listen for more stories of preservation in North Dakota as we continue to acknowledge National Historic Preservation Month. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In the UK, a study explores whether giving people doses of two different COVID-19 vaccines is as good or even better than administering the same one twice.
We're sort of calling it mix and match.
Something scientists have tried with other diseases.
HIV, malaria, even influenza. So there's ample evidence for the benefits of such strategies.
A new trial that could reshape the way people are vaccinated on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Just a few minutes left in today's Main Street to remind you that we are in our spring member drive. With your investment, you are making everything that you hear on Prairie Public possible. And it starts with a simple phone call or a text. 1-800-359-4145 is the number. You can call or you can text the word donate. Again, it's 800 800- 859-4145. You can also go to our secure website, prairiepublic.org, and make your investment in whatever amount is comfortable to you. But, you know, one of the most enduring segments on Prairie Public is that Dakota Daybook. We're airing it every day on Main Street, and we air it at other day parts as well. People set their alarms to it. They're like, oh, I heard Dakota Daybook. I got to go to the office. Remember when we used to go to the office for things?
Starting again.
And, yeah.
Well, and you know, here's something interesting. People often ask, like, well, how much should I donate? What's the amount? I'll tell you, the most common amount is around $10 a month to Prairie Public. Now, some people donate quite a bit more than that. Some people donate less than that, but around $10 a month. And that is a great amount to give. But if you can up it to $20 a month, which works out for many people, and you look at your other expenses and you go like $20 a month compared to what I spend on, and, you know, just think of some things
insert,
to fill in the
Netflix,
blank there.
Netflix, ice cream, cat treats.
Right.
I don't get out much.
Well, if you pledge $20 a month, we'll send you a copy of the Dakota Daybook book that was made with a Dakota Daybook for every day of the year. And we got a lot of them. There'll be another one coming out, but we have one already. Dakota Daybook, the book, is available with a $20 a month pledge, $240 a year to Prairie Public when you call 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org.
It really does make a difference. I cannot stress that enough. So often people think, well, what is $5 a month really going to do? But you have to realize that that is part of being in a group of people. It would be sort of the same as if you're going to church and passing around the collection plate, your $5, somebody else's $5, another person's, you know, $1, another person's $20. All of that adds up together. And we do have around 15,000 total members for Prairie Public.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are looking at $5 and $10 a month, or, you know, maybe you're doing that $20 a month and grabbing Dakota Daybook, then all of a sudden we're looking at a number that can really make a substantial difference. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
It is the biggest part of our income. It is the biggest portion of our income. We really count on you as a listener to put in support, and many, many people do, and we say thanks to the people who have done it, but you can do it too.
And we'll say thank you to you.
Yes. 800-359-4145. Call or text or go to prairiepublic.org.
Coming up tomorrow on the show, Awareness, Whispers from Nature. It's a new book from photographer and poet Ken Burkhartsmeyer, who joins me to talk about how growing up in the state shaped his art. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. In the meantime, we hope you can still make an investment by calling or texting the word donate to 1-800-359-4145. And thanks.